has cost very well. So our next case for argument is Phillips versus Asset Acceptance. Mr. Edelman?
May it please the court, counsel. Asset Acceptance filed lawsuits on natural gas debts more than 4 years after default. It did so in about 800 cases. The UCC defines natural gas as goods. The UCC provides a 4-year statute of limitations. We filed suit under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, alleging it was violated by filing suit on time-barred debts. The violation was committed with respect to the entire class. This case was filed in 2009. By November 29, 2010, the original discovery and briefing on the class certification issue were complete. The district court requested some additional briefs and information. That was completed by March 15th of 2011. 25 months later, the district court issues a decision denying class certification on grounds not related to the additional ones that briefing was requested on. Specifically, the district court decided first that plaintiff was not representative of persons sued between 4 and 5 years after default. He then decided that the persons over 5 years were not sufficiently numerous to have a class, and that was done by eliminating persons who were served, who were sued but not served. So the district court assumed that the statute could be 5 years, although no one has cited any authority from anywhere to that effect.
May I stop you for a second? Because I really want to ask you this. If we were to decide that the district court should have determined the statute of limitations issue, is it your opinion that we should remand for a determination of the statute of limitations and then a redetermination of the class certification issue, or could this court make a decision about the statute of limitations as a purely legal question and then remand for a determination on class certification in light of our finding?
I believe that the statute of limitations issue is a pure question of law. No one has cited any authority for the proposition that anything other than the 4-year statute applies. The UCC defines natural gas after removal from the ground as goods. The UCC drafters obviously understood that with gas and oil, there are substantial delivery costs. You need a pipeline, a pressure vessel, or a tank. They nevertheless defined gas and oil as goods. That is why we alleged
why isn't it governed by the 10-year statute of limitations for written contracts, suits on written contracts?
Because the Illinois 10-year statute contains an express exception for transactions which are governed by the UCC statute of limitations.
But is it possible that when the UCC defined natural gas as a good, it was referring to the sale of natural gas wholesale by those who severed from the ground? Because that seems to be the focus of the language of 2-107, and it seems that once it's severed and sold by a reseller to an individual, to an individual consumer, it becomes more of a service contract than one for goods. So could there be a distinction there?
The UCC does not draw such a distinction, and I'm unaware of any other case in which the delivery expense makes something a service when it isn't. Even at the wholesale level, gas requires, or oil requires, means of delivery which are expensive compared to a modest quantity of gas or oil. You need to build a pipeline, you need to deliver it by tanker or pressure vessel. So no distinction was made in that regard by the drafters, and there's nothing in the statutory language which would suggest such a distinction. The cases that the defendant cites dealing with predominant purpose deal with questions where, for example, there is an issue as to whether I have purchased 5 tons of building materials or a completed house, where there is some actual transformation other than what is required simply to deliver the building materials to me if I've purchased them in that state. So there is no case law which supports the proposition that the cost of delivery turns gas, oil, or anything else into anything other than the sale of goods, unless it is transformed in some manner.
Now, you want to represent the whole group of more than 4 years, is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
It wouldn't, there's no upper limit, is there? I mean, are people ever sued like 20 years later or?
It's been known to happen. It's unusual.
I don't think so, yeah.
But it happens.
Yeah, right. I wouldn't be surprised. So if there are people like that, they would be part of your class. That would be your argument.
That is correct. I don't think such people actually exist in this case.
Pardon?
I don't think such people actually exist in this case. But there is no upper limit. It's just more than 4 years. That was the only statute of limitations for the states at issue that we, after research, had believed had any applicability, and we just don't think there's a...
Would you be seeking damages for people who had been sued but not served? Because, of course, you know, if you're sued, I assume, even if you're not served, you know, it can go on a credit record and...
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is that part of what you would be looking for in damages?
Those persons are entitled
to just statutory damages?
Statutory damages, Your Honor. The court should determine that they should not have been sued and award statutory damages to them. That would enable them to have something to go, for example, to a credit bureau and try to get this removed from their record.
On a different note, I just want to make sure I have a handle on how many states' laws are implicated here. One section of your brief says 9 states. Another, you say 4 states, mm-hmm. and you argue to the district court primarily the members would be from 3 states. Could you clarify that for me?
Yes. The vast majority of class members are from Illinois and 3 other states. There are a few in an additional 5 states, sometimes very few. The complaint, before we got into any discovery, identified which jurisdictions have the standard UCC provisions defining gas as goods and the standard 4-year statute, both of those.
And is it undisputed that the UCC statute of limitations applies in Illinois, Michigan, New Jersey, and Texas?
The defendant argued that you apply a predominant purpose test based on the delivery cost, and we don't think that is a matter of law that has anything to do with the issue. So there's simply a legal issue as on that score. There are no other statutes of limitation which specifically apply, for example, to the delivery of gas and oil. It's either this one or some general in Illinois, the 10-year statute, which we don't think there is a basis for.
There's some sort of mysterious gap in the district court's consideration of this case. There was some 2 years got lost. What was that about, that delay?
I cannot explain it. The district court said that he would decide promptly. No decision came. The various parties from time to time filed motions asking for status conferences or submitted new case law. And I cannot explain the 25-month time lapse.
So the Judge Fineman didn't give an explanation for the 25 months?
No, Your Honor. There is nothing in the record which supports that.
Because it was the same judge over the whole period.
For purposes of the, yes, it was reassigned to Judge Fineman shortly after it was filed when he took the bench, but that's correct. It's not a reassignment of the case in month 12 either. I've touched upon Tyler, the Sixth Circuit case, which recognizes that the filing of a case is picked up by credit bureaus and the like. We believe that the fundamental error here was that the district court assumed that it might be a five-year statute and never actually decided it, although this court in Szabo and American Honda has instructed that there should be legal and factual findings on whatever issues are necessary to make the class certification decision. This sort of turns, goes back to pre-Szabo law, but turns it on its head. Prior to Szabo, it was common practice if the plaintiff contended A, and A would produce a class-wide recovery, but the defendant said, no, B is the correct factual legal proposition, and the class as a whole can't recover. The common practice was to certify the class, and the common question would be, is A correct? Szabo and its progeny counsel that the court should actually decide whether A or B is correct. What happened here was that the court only looked at the contentions, but then in effect said that if the defendant can come up with an argument, plausible or not so plausible, for breaking up the class, I won't certify it, and I won't decide whether the defendant is correct or that the argument is even colorable. For example, with respect to the defendant raised a bona fide error claim. On the question of law, you basically have a requirement in the Seeger and Ruth cases that you obtain a competent legal opinion. The asset staff attorney who signed off on and presented the complaints in state court testified that it was not his responsibility to determine what the statute of limitations period was. The asset attorney in Michigan who selected the five-year statute, Mr. Beach, refused to testify as to why he did this, which disqualifies asset from meeting any burden of proof in this regard.
What do you think is the size of the class?
Approximately 800.
It got carved down by
that's the class we defined.
Right. Does that include entities that Asset Acceptance pays to bring the suit?
I'm sorry? Entities?
Doesn't Asset Acceptance hire other or assign claims to other entities to bring suits?
In most of the larger states at this point in time, it was using in-house staff attorneys, such as Mr. Gunn, to bring the lawsuits. It was using
So the people sued by Linkhouse or whatever, they're part of the class?
By whom?
They're part of your class. You say the actual suit was brought by something called Linkhouse?
No, an in-house staff attorney.
So your class are people actually sued by Asset rather than by an assignee?
That is correct. The name on the pleadings is Asset versus Consumer in all cases.
Okay, so you say 800 and...
There's, it was 793 to be precise. And by breaking it into the 4 and 5 year segment and then eliminating the people who were sued but not served, he got it down to 23.
That's how it gets down to 23.
Yes, and then decided that wasn't numerous enough.
No, that's clear. Okay, well, thank you,
Mr. Gale.
So, Mr. Gale?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, opposing counsel. Essentially, the appellant asked this court to determine whether the district court abused its discretion by determining that the plaintiff, the putative class representative, had not satisfied her burden to prove the elements of Rule 23A. It is our contention that the district court did not abuse its discretion in that regard.
I don't really understand your position.
Okay.
I don't understand. Why are the people who aren't served excluded?
Because they were not damaged. Because it's not a violation.
No. It is damaging to be sued.
Well, let me. I apologize, Your Honor. I meant to say something different. It is not a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act sections that are at issue in this lawsuit to file but not serve a lawsuit. Under 1692E, in order to be a violation, we would have to mislead or deceive the consumer. If we file a lawsuit and the consumer has no idea that the lawsuit has been filed, we have not communicated that by filing it, then it cannot be deceptive and it cannot be misleading. For that reason, that's not a violation of 1692E to file but not serve a lawsuit. The other FDCPA violation, which they allege, is 1692F, that would prohibit the unconscionable collection or attempt to collect a debt. Again, if we do not serve a lawsuit that has been filed, the filing of that lawsuit without service would not be an attempt to collect that debt. And there's actually case law support for each of those points.
Why wouldn't this person, when he learns of this suit, no one will give him credit or anything? What if he goes to Asset Acceptance and says, can we make a deal or something? Because I want to get my credit record clear. Doesn't that ever happen?
I don't know if it ever happens. There's nothing in the record to note to state that it ever happened for any of the people that are the putative members of this particular class. And so to the extent, that's another reason why, for example, we have a commonality question to the extent we try to include all of the people who were sued but not served. Because some of those people would know about the lawsuit, but most of them likely would not know about the lawsuit. Once they learned of the lawsuit, some of those people would choose to try to defend it even if they had not been served. Some of them would treat it as they had treated the debts and ignore it and let it go forward. So you end up with a commonality
What would be the size of the class if all the unserved were subtracted from Mr. Edelman's 800 figure?
That depends also on whether it's 5 years after the date that the debt accrued or 4 years after the date.
That I don't understand.
Okay, well, should I take a moment and explain that?
But no. Assuming the 4 years are in along with the 5 years.
Okay, if we assume a 5-year class, and if we assume
that's my question. If four and fives and everybody are in,
right.
But just the unserved are subtracted, how many are there?
Candidly, I don't know the number. I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I was trying to answer. Maybe that's why I was trying to answer the question I actually know the answer to. If we draw the class at 5 years after the debt accrued rather than 4 years, and I'll explain in a moment why that is, and if we eliminate the people who were sued but not served, the class size is actually even smaller than what's represented in the papers. We, in response to further interrogatories, so additional discovery that's been going on at the district court level, we alerted the plaintiffs and responded in the middle of September that if the class is 5 years or more, and if we talk about it, if it's 5 years or more, there were a total of 31 lawsuits filed, but only 10 lawsuits served in Illinois.
What classes have been certified with as few as 10 class members?
Well, the question becomes, as we look at numerosity, okay, is it impracticable to serve 10 people, all of whom live within the state of Illinois and all of whom can be identified through our records?
But these people, they don't have enough at stake to bring a lawsuit. Mm.
But they could be joined. Certainly Mr. Edelman's firm could reach out to them, and they could be joined the same as they could be joined as absent class members. I mean, at this point in time, this case was filed in 2009. No other putative class members have come forward other than Ms. Phillips, of which we're aware. None whatsoever.
Now, why do you want to – I don't understand why you want to exclude the four-year people.
Why it should be 5 years instead of 4 years?
Because, there's a question whether it's a four-year or five-year statute of limitations.
The question becomes whether these natural gas contracts, these contracts to deliver natural gas to people's residences, are predominantly goods sales or predominantly service contracts. And similar to what the court said a couple of months ago in the Butler versus Sears Roebuck case, when you were talking about predominance in a Rule 23B3 sort of circumstance, to try to figure out what predominates here, whether it's goods or whether it's services, I think it's important not to sort of count that, you know, as the court put it there, count noses, but to look at what is really the essential nature of this contract. It's absolutely true.
I understand. What does that have to do with certification?
Yeah. But the reason it has to do with certification is in order for them to have a four-year class as opposed to a five-year class, they need to convince a court that it's primarily a sale of goods. It's the UCC statute of limitations on which they choose to rely, and that would be cover only the sale of goods.
Wait, I don't understand. If you're barred by the statute of limitations, is the notion that if the 5-year statute is the proper, that's your argument, it's the 5-year statute.
That's correct.
Well, what about someone who's, so your argument would be someone, if someone is sued after 4 years, the suit is within the statute of limitations, so it's not harassment. Is that the idea?
That is correct. That if they're sued and the statute of limitations on that debt has not run.
So your argument is that this is such an important question for the size of the class that the judge has to resolve it before certification?
The question should be resolved at the district court level because it is a fact-driven inquiry. It is the burden of the plaintiff in seeking to certify this class to convince the district court that he has met all of the elements of Rule 23A and 23B.
Why couldn't we decide whether or not the 4-year statute is applicable?
Because at this point in time, this is still before the district court. This goes back at some level to the question.
It's before the district court. Isn't this just an issue of law, whether a 4- or 5-year statute?
I believe it's not just an issue of law, Your Honor, and the reason I say that is because it's a fact-driven inquiry
What's
to determine. The facts that drive it would be for a residential natural gas contract, is that primarily a delivery of goods or a delivery of services?
That sounds like a legal question.
Well,
what's the factual dimension?
The factual issue is this. If one way to look at it, it seems to me, is this. When one buys a house, there are a number of ways that you can heat it, that you can cook your food, that you can dry your clothes. You can use heating oil or gas or electricity to heat it. Some people might choose to buy a house because it has gas service and doesn't have electric service or whatever else. But who would buy a house if the gas service worked sometimes and sometimes it didn't? Who would buy a house if the gas service had blown up for the last owners and the gas company couldn't say for sure whether or not it would be safe now?
So I'm looking at the statutes.
Yes.
Illinois statutes, and it looks as if we're faced with just an interpretation question. Mm-hmm. Are gas contracts, you know, are they governed by the 4-year or the 5-year? So.
Right.
Aren't there cases on that? Has this issue ever arisen before?
Not in this context, it never has. There are certainly a number of cases that were cited to this court, not to the district court below, because the plaintiff really didn't bring this issue to the fore at the district court level. But there are a number of cases that have been cited, some of which say natural gas is a good, some of which say it's not, some of which say electricity, which is in some sense.
Wouldn't that be a typical question for an appellate court to resolve? There's a disagreement over these natural gas contracts, and we have to fit it in one statute or another, and why can't we do that?
Because it's within the district court's discretion, and he has not yet exercised it.
I understand that. I don't get that. he spent 25 months. He can't resolve this issue. Maybe we should try to resolve. If it's just a legal issue, we can decide any legal issue. We don't have this. What's the discretion? And the district judge doesn't have discretion in interpretation.
It seems to me that the district court followed the path that it explained to the parties it would follow. Let me explain. After briefing on class certification, the district court asked for some supplemental briefing. That came in early February of 2011. And then there was a hearing on March 15th. Now, part of the colloquy between the district court and plaintiff's counsel from that hearing is quoted directly in the district court's opinion. But what's instructive particularly is two pages later. And I would commend to the court's reading, this is record entry 117, and it's the transcript from that hearing. At that point, the district court asked the parties, how does this four-year versus five-year issue get decided? Plaintiff's counsel said that would be on a motion. We would file a summary judgment motion on that issue at law at some appropriate point in time. The court then turned to my colleague and said, do you agree with that? And we said yes. So during that 2.5 years, after that last hearing, before the court came out with its order, never at any point in time did plaintiff file this motion. The district court has not had the full opportunity.
So what? Look, you're missing the point. If there's a pure question of law, the Court of Appeals does not give any deference to the district judge's ruling. Zero.
I hear and understand what you're saying, and I'm trying, I guess, to respectfully disagree, and I'm doing a poor job.
So why should this case be extended indefinitely to give the district judge, I mean, you know, there may be something, he might think of something we didn't think of and so on. But this case has been dragging for such a long time. Wouldn't it be much cleaner for us to decide the four versus five-year issue and then decide whether, if we agreed with you, was the five-year, is there enough left in the class to warrant a class action or send it back to the judge to, having clarified the legal issue, then he could decide whether there's enough here for a class. Wouldn't that be better?
I hear and understand what you're saying. Respectfully, we believe that the district court should decide it.
Where is the factual dispute the district court has to decide? As I understand it, we don't have a situation here where, you know, the gas line blew up or it wasn't none of that.
That's correct.
Very, very clear. It's just like interpreting whether 4 or 5 years apply. So where's the factual dispute?
It's really a question of determining whether in a residential delivery of natural gas, that's primarily goods or primarily services.
And that's a question of law. That's what we're saying. That's a question of law. Unless somebody has to put something in to define. There's no factual dispute.
UCC 2107? That defines gas as a good.
It certainly does.
And gas is different from electricity and water because it's specifically identified in the UCC as a good, where water and electricity are not.
And if it were clear that we were talking only about the purchase of gas and not also the delivery of gas, you would be absolutely correct. There is no question, and we don't dispute.
There's no difference. Does anybody purchase gas? In tanks, it's always delivered through a pipe, or not have any gas, right?
Well, that's fair to say. Not all natural gas deliveries are created equal, though. I mean, let's remember what we're talking about here
consumers
who use it to heat
their
homes.
Natural gas delivery.
I'm sorry?
What are the differences?
Well, you know, natural gas is used, a large quantity of natural gas, probably most in the United States, is used for industrial purposes. It's made to exactly right.
What's
that's my
the point of bringing in industrial uses? What has that to do with this case?
Because the UCC defines natural gas as a good. Natural gas is sold to a number of different parties in different contexts using different methods.
So, but we're only dealing with one context here,
that's
right? Like how?
That's correct.
So, like, why can't we decide in one context?
Right.
And that wouldn't have implication for all these other, you know, it's going to support this industry or this factory or whatever. It's one context. So why can't we decide in the one context of houses? being delivered to houses and residential places.
I'm certainly hearing and understanding what all of you are saying about that. The one point would be, and I see that my time is running out as well, one point would be that this, to the extent that we're talking about a multi-state class and whether this particular issue should be that it, whether natural gas is considered a good for residential delivery or whether it's considered a service for residential delivery, you know, if you look at, for example, the Thorogood versus Sears Roebuck case, this strikes me as the type of issue that for federalism reasons should be decided by the state.
A separate question is, if you have a multi-state class action, are there divergences in the law of the states which are going to make the proceeding very complicated? And if it ever went to a jury trial, you might decide to subdivide by states. And, of course, you have a small class. Mm-hmm. You start subdividing, you may end up with nothing. Okay, those are all problems. Mm-hmm. And so if it turns out that in these four states you have very divergent answers to this legal question, that would certainly be material. Mm-hmm. But why wouldn't that be something we can investigate as well as the district judge?
You certainly could decide it. The point that I was trying to make is I do not believe that the district court has abused its discretion by coming to the conclusion that the plaintiff did not establish what she needed to establish in order to get the conclusion that she sought from the district court.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you, Mr. Gale.
Thank you.
So Mr. Edelman? Oops. Let me just ask you about the first point that Mr. Gale made, which had to do with the question whether 1692 ERF could embrace the people who were not served.
It does, Your Honor. I think it particularly does under this Court's recent decision in Todd versus Colecto, which gets into whether it has to be a communication to the debtor or could be a communication, for example, to a credit bureau. 692E8 expressly covers credit reporting, which necessarily means that communications picked up by to credit bureaus or that picked up by credit bureaus are within the scope of 1692E.
So this argument he makes about it being misleading, it has to be misleading or some misrepresentation, isn't it? Error? Is that what you're saying?
That is correct, Your Honor. It is wrong. The leading case on this issue is the Kimber versus Federal Financial, which was decided in the 1980s and has been consistently followed, and that found that filing on time-barred debts is a violation of both E and F, and both because it misleads and because it has these collateral impacts.
Well, is the notion that misleading a credit bureau by filing a groundless suit is like misleading a...
1692E8 expressly covers false information to a credit bureau.
That's the basis of the...
Among others.
Is that your basis for bringing in the unsued class members?
Our basis for bringing in is that they're injured. The unserved class members are injured at least as much as the consumer in Bartlett versus Heibel, who received a defective letter, didn't open it, took it to his lawyer, and was held entitled to recover as a matter of law. The filing of the time-barred lawsuit has an impact on the debtor. It is a communication. It is picked up by the credit bureaus. They know it is picked up by the credit bureaus. It is unfair because it is a brick on the consumer's credit.
But Mr. Gale said that 1692E is about misleading. So is there an element of misleading? I see the injury. That's clear. But
It is misleading, as it's set forth at some length in Kimber, because the unsophisticated consumer is not familiar with the operation of the statutes of limitation or even what it is, and is likely, for example, as Your Honor put it, upon finding out about the lawsuit, call Asset and make a deal because he thinks they have a right to recover from him.
Well, but would that have to be shown? Is that the nature?
I think that once they file a...
That would complicate the class a great deal.
Once they file a time-barred lawsuit, it is a misleading conduct, and the debtor is impacted. How the debtor is injured may vary, but for purposes of recovering statutory damages, it's not necessary to get into that.
Statutory damage, you don't worry about differences between them.
So that's also the distinction. It's the mere filing of the lawsuit when it's outside the period of statute of limitations.
Yes. Once that happens,
would mislead the debtor.
It's misleading conduct and it's unfair conduct, and once it is done, it has an impact on the debtor, whether the debtor defaults, whether the debtor calls them up and pays money, whether the debtor is not served and it turns out to be a brick on the debtor's credit. Whatever exactly happens, they're harmed. They should get statutory damages. I see my time is up. I have...
Thank you. Yes, of course. Yes.
For Ms. Phillips, what, if you know, would be the difference between her getting statutory damages or real damages?
As a practical matter, none.
Exactly.
We charged a modest amount, I believe, and she had to pay an appearance fee to appear and defend the state court case. But if she got $1,000, that would cover those items.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you
thank
very
you.
Much, Mr. Edelman, and thank you, Mr. Gale. And we'll move on to